In our Tuesday regional spot, we're on the Otago Peninsula, and it's a good news story. This is the sound of the Royal Northern Albatross. From the Natural History Unit Sound Archive, that's the Royal Northern Albatross, and a small colony of the birds nest on Otago Peninsula, and they've laid the second highest number of eggs ever recorded at the colony. Huani Langsbury is the manager of ecotourism at the Otago Peninsula Trust, and he's with me now. Kia ora, Huani.
Kia ora, Karen. How are you?
Very good. And how is Otago Peninsula this evening?
I live about 3 km from the Albatross colony, and there's a light breeze, and from home I can see a couple of adults flying, so it's all good here on the peninsula.
I was just having a look at the live cam. That's exciting.
Oh, isn't it? Yeah, they moved it to an actual nest in the last couple of days, so that'll keep 500,000 people happy for the next 6 or 7 months.
Who is that bird that's on that nest?
Good question. I think it is, and we refer to them by the colours of their bands. So it's LGL, and LGK is the male partner of that pair.
LGL and LGK?
Yeah.
That's exotic.
Isn't it? We do run a competition every year now to name the chick. So the last year's chick before it fledged was named Atify.
That's right. Fantastic name.
Absolutely.
What a thrill. How many birds returned to Tairoa Head for the breeding season?
So far this year, we've seen more than 120. So, yeah, that's a record in itself.
Is it? How many would you normally see?
Usually around 100 is what we would have seen by about this time. And we've had a couple of years where the numbers are going up and down, but we think we're kind of getting back into bumps.
What would be the reason for the increase? Any speculation or knowledge about that?
Well, our higher season was due to a failed breeding of quite a few in the previous year. So they only breed every second year, but if they fail early in their breeding cycle, say, I don't know, an egg fails or something happens to the chick, then they'll return the following year and breed. So that's where we get out of balance. If we have some returning on the same year and then others returning 2 years apart. So
it's wonderful this time round because it's the second highest number of eggs ever recorded at the colony. And how many is that?
So we've had 41 eggs so far. So and we're still waiting for one that's a really slow breeder. Last time they were here a couple of years ago, they laid their egg 2 weeks after everyone else. So just wanting to kind of stand out, you know, that late arrival.
How big is an egg? Like, what size is it?
I would say if you put your hands together, kind of in a clapping position with your thumbs and your fingers wrapping around each other,
You're
about that size.
Gee, they're quite big.
They're large. Yeah.
They're big, aren't they?
Oh, they are.
Depending on what size hands you've got, of course.
That's right. It's been a long time since I've seen your hands. So it's been a long time since you've been on TV, I presume.
I've got hands, so that's quite good.
Yeah, So, you know, so I thought I would work with something that you do I was talking about.
Very good. So what is it about albatrosses that means they only breed every second year? It's just that's their cycle. Is that common for birds or this particular?
No, it's because of their size. So the Northern Royals are second largest seabirds, so they have a 3-metre wingspan. And though their chicks fledge in September, they return in about the same period. So they spend 6 months working really hard, and then 6 months where they're quietly looking after those chicks. So you need to have a year off. 11 months of your life looking after a chick, and they might lose 20 to 30% of their body weight during that time.
What do they eat? What do they feed them?
Mostly squid and octopus.
Wow, that's it. Nothing else.
No, so because they're so large, they can't dive or submerge, so they're opportunistic scavengers, so they scavenge food off the surface.
And that is there's a difference between squid and octopus. Are they different things?
They are. So, you know, squid come to the surface at night due to the sunlight, the moonlight, I should say. And they also, when they breed, they die and float to the surface. Where octopus are bottom feeders. So there's something else in the mix that brings them to the surface. We're thinking some kind of marine mammal or something, or a shark might get a octopus and bring it out to the surface and play with it. And some darn albatross comes along and steals off.
And takes it back to the nest.
Yeah, swallows it and then regurgitates it. And the reason we know that is a couple of years ago there was some research done and there were 50 octopus beaks found next to a nest. So we know they're being brought back and fed to their chicks, and that's about the only bit of an octopus that they can't digest.
That's a lot of octopi, perhaps they are in the plural, I'm not sure.
That would be correct.
Gee, they eat a lot then, don't they, over those 5 months, did you say?
That's right. So once they've hatched in early February, those chicks are on a diet of up to about 2 kilos a meal whenever one of their parents turns up. And then they might get up to 10 to 12 kilos by August and their parents put them on a diet because they've got to lose some weight so they can fly. And by September, they get down to the weight of an adult, which is about 8 to 10 kilos. Flying weight, we call that, and a big breeze will come along September, October, and their feet might leave the ground while they're testing their wings, and that's how they're gone, because they never learn how to land.
They never learn how to land?
No, so once a chick fledges on that first flight, it doesn't touch land again for 5 to 6 years when it returns to the headland for the first time, and they kind of just fall out of the sky. They stall about a metre off the ground and crash into the ground, and then they can't walk for 2 to 3 days because they've never had to use their legs since they were a chick.
That's phenomenal. They're in the air for 5 or 6 years.
Yep, so they'll sleep on the water, but they don't have to hold up their own body weight with their legs until they return to land to start that courtship and that breeding process over again.
Where are they going to when they head off? How far do they go?
They'll spend a short amount of time on the coast of New Zealand, then they kind of turn right and they fly 9,500 kilometres to the coast of Chile. And they do that in about 12 days and they'll spend maybe up to 6 months on the Humboldt Current feeding themselves up there, and then they spend the next 4 to 5 years circumnavigating the planet in the roaring 40s and ferocious 50s. And then eventually returning back here to the headland. Dunedin's at 45 degrees south, so we're right in the middle of those really strong Antarctic or cyclonic winds that they use to travel the planet on.
Gee, it's incredible, isn't it? What a lifespan. And how long would an albatross live for?
Well, Grandma is the oldest albatross we've recorded here at Tairua Head, and she was disappeared at the age of 62, and she was still breeding at that age.
Human years of 62.
Human years of 62, correct.
And can you tell us, I know that you've probably told this story 100 times, but why are they considered bad luck by sailors?
That's a myth. So, you know, if I was putting on my Māori hat rather than my Pākehā hat, they are a tong or a treasure to us, and they manage to create their own fresh water when they're out on the ocean. That is all desalination plants in there, and they excrete that salt through their nostrils. So when we're looking at them, we refer to that as the tears of the albatross. But when you think about it from a Pākehā perspective, I think it probably goes back to Coleridge and the rhyme of the
Ancient Mariner.
That's the one. I'm glad I've got you there to help me out with that one. And the terrible things that sailors may have done to albatross that were following their ships. So,
yeah, there are different cultural perspectives, obviously. When you say the Māori perspective, this area is where you're from. Your whenua is Otago, which is at the entrance to the Otago Harbour.
That's right. And yeah, my ancestors used to wear the albatross feather in their hair or in their hats as a sign of mana or respect, and that gift was given to the Taranaki when they were here incarcerated as part of those Maori land wars, and we've never worn it since. So since that time, the white albatross feather represents pacifism.
Can you explain that a little further for me? I'm a little unsure of what you mean by when Taranaki...
So Te Whiti o Rongomai was the spiritual leader of the Taranaki for Parihaka. And during the land wars, when those people were incarcerated, when their land was forcibly taken, some of them got shipped to Dunedin because there weren't enough prisons in the North Island to keep them. So he was incarcerated down here with many of the Taranaki. And during that time, he was allowed to take services with the people of Otago on Sunday. So they attended church, and it was during that period that that gift of the albatross feather was given to the Taranaki. As Otago Marae, we recently, a couple of years back, went on a hikoi after Taranaki and Parihaka, and they shared a story of how when the soldiers were about to take the pā, that an albatross came and landed in the marae up here and walked around there for the day, and then it just lifted off and took off again. And they thought that was a bit of a myth until we told them how albatross fly, and they kind of stretch their wings out because they're so big, a big gust of wind comes along and lifts them up and they fly off, so they don't run and take off like other birds. So, you know, there's lots of close relationships that the people of Otago have with the people of the Taranaki.
And it would be unlikely that an albatross would be in that area, would it?
Exactly. You're not a normal place for an albatross to be. So it was just reinforcing those linkages between the people of the time.
Gee, well, you're in absolutely the right place.
That's right.
Where you need to be. That's amazing. What a great job you've got.
Oh, that's right. That's a real job. I enjoy going to work every day. I even enjoyed being able to go down there and check on things during those troubling times that we've had recently. It reminds us of the difference between us and the rest of the animal world.
What troubling times are those, Huani?
Those are the COVID times.
Oh, those.
We all were locked down and, you know,
yes.
I had to go and check on traps and all those sort of things, and appreciate all the wildlife that was utilising the headland with no people around. It was just a different place.
Oh, you're a lucky man. Well, brilliant. Well, thank you so much for just a little brief view into your life and the life of the Royal Northern Albatross. What's the Māori name for that bird?
We refer to them as toro. So, and that's the slow breeder I talked about earlier.
Yep.
He was the 500th chick bred on the headland. That would be over a decade ago now, probably, when we hit 500th chick. And probably the other single piece of information that's useful is Lance Ridsdale observed the first chick being fledged there in only 1938. So it's only in recent times that toro have been breeding at Pukekura.
Gee, thanks for joining us tonight. Really good to hear that story. And we've all got a visual now, and I'm going to get that live cam up on our Facebook page so people can enjoy it.
Give me a call any time. We're not going anywhere. We'll be here watching those birds breed all year.
Oh, good on you. Oh, great to talk to you. Thank you very much.
You too. Thanks, Karen.
That's Huani Langsbury from Otago Peninsula Trust.